Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my inspiring conversation with Candace Hoole, a proud member of the Cree Nation and a beloved Freedom Writer teacher. We discuss Candace's experiences growing up as a First Nation Canadian, the historical interactions between the Indigenous culture and European settlers, and the revelations about the mistreatment of Aboriginal students at residential schools. This episode is incredibly powerful, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. In 1968, U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed legislation creating a new federal holiday to celebrate the arrival of European explorers in North America. 3 years later, on October 11, 1971, the United States observed Columbus Day for the first time. However, in the 50 years since its first observance, updated narratives about Christopher Columbus and other European explorers have made the national holiday controversial in many communities in the United States. Recently, many U.S. states, counties, and cities have replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, a day that celebrates the Native Americans who welcomed Columbus and other explorers to their continent. And for the first time ever, Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day was celebrated together at the national level after U.S. President Joe Biden's proclamation on October 8, 2021. The movement to refocus the holiday has become even more pressing after the discovery of mass graves of Indigenous schoolchildren at residential schools throughout the provinces of Canada. These residential boarding schools were designed to assimilate Indigenous children into the communities of white settlers. Sadly, children were taken away from their communities, stripped of their identity, native names, and given a European-style education. Many of the Indigenous children in these residential schools never returned home. When the last of these schools closed in 1997, there were an estimated 3,200 missing students whose graves have yet to be found. Today's guest, Candace Hoole, is not only a Freedom Writer teacher, but she is also a proud member of the Cree Nation. I've been lucky enough to visit Candace's community in Alberta, Canada, and meet with her family members, many of whom are active members in their tribe's leadership. Because of her experiences and expertise, Candace seemed like the ideal guest to help us honor the newly decreed Indigenous Peoples Day. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Candace Hoole. There are moments as a teacher where I have just stood in awe, where the hairs on my arm stand at alert, when I have butterflies in my stomach and my tear ducts well up with pride. And I had such a moment with our guest today. We made an invitation for Candace Hoole to become a Freedom Writer teacher. And in doing so, I humbly took a step back from being a teacher and immediately became her student. And what I learned each and every moment that she stood in front of the Freedom Writers and fellow teachers is there were lessons to be learned that I never read in a textbook, lessons to be learned that I never learned in a classroom or university, and lessons that needed to be learned that I would then have to pay forward to others. And I love when history comes to life by those who've lived it. So today is going to be an incredible anthropological study about looking at not only her Indigenous roots, but paying homage and honor and great humility to anyone who is Indigenous, who have had their rights stripped, who have been sidelined or marginalized, and giving a voice to the voiceless. So I expect for all of our listeners to have those same feelings that I had, goosebumps, hairs on their arms standing up, and tears welling in their eyes when Candace pays homage to her tribe, to her people, and to her culture. So welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, Candace.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, I want to start when I met you. What I was so excited about is I met you and many of your family members, many of whom were elders and tribal chiefs. in Alberta, Canada. So can you tell me a little bit of your family background for those who are not aware of Alberta, Canada, your province, and your reserve?
So I'm just going to start off a little bit with an introduction in my language. Dantse gakyo nituti tik egwaniwaku maganak nimiwitin gakyo ipitute eganuts Candace Hul Nitsigasan Unitsik Skupunik Utsinia Sagit Dinawa Gakio. So I'm very thankful that you're here today, my friends and family. My name is Candace Hul. I'm from the Satellite Cree Nation that's located in Alberta, Canada, in the Treaty 6 territory. So I've grown up in my community and attending an off-reserve school for my entire K to 12 years. And then I attended our local community college. The college that I attended was actually a residential school that many of my families attended over the course of the year, probably up to three generations prior to me. And my experience at the residential school was far different from the experience my relatives and ancestors experienced. I attended and completed my first degree there and then later moved to Edmonton and did an after degree there and then a graduate degree with the University of Alberta as well. So having said that, I come from a family that really instills and values education. They instill and value westernized education, but still wanting us to know who we are and where we come from and embrace our Indigenous epistemologies. My grandmother, late Alice Makokis, was a member of the strong movers and shakers that sat at the table with the government who were wanting to sell the Blue Quills residential school to a local town. At that time, my grandmother and all of the other trailblazers sat together and worked collectively to ensure that that didn't happen because they believed in the power of ourselves, our people, and they knew that in future we could provide an education for ourselves that was even stronger than a westernized education.
What I loved about visiting Treaty 6 when I was in Alberta was your family, especially your father, fighting for your Cree language to be taught in schools throughout Alberta. So can you talk about how sad it was at one point when the language was taken out of schools, forbidden in homes, and how your family has really fought the powers that be to get it reinstated in schools and in homes?
It's quite emotional for me because it's near and dear to my heart. So growing up, and I don't want to age myself, but growing up, I didn't have the opportunity to even learn my language. And one day sitting at home with my parents and grandparents, I asked why I wasn't taught the language. And the answer that I received was, we didn't want you to feel the hurt and pain and the repercussions that we had to feel for learning our language. We wanted to protect you. So over the course of the years, there was a large movement from many people, many Indigenous people, including our parents and our grandparents, to encourage and almost enforce that the expectation of having the language, the identity, and all of those cultural experiences and practices embedded in our education system. We are still continuing to battle with that today. It's an ongoing battle, but I have to say, each day I feel more and more hope. I feel more and more inspired. I feel excited. I think we are a lot further ahead than we were 10 years ago and further ahead than we were 15 years ago. So I feel that all those that have played an important role and have been involved in such have been very instrumental and have left a strong legacy. And I feel it's our responsibility to continue on with that legacy to ensure that our children who are attending schools don't only receive that westernized education, but they come out being confident and proud of who they are and where they come from. and being able to walk two worlds comfortably and with a solid foundation.
Candace, what you said makes me sad when you think of walking in two worlds comfortably. You mentioned the pain, the hurt, and the repercussions that clearly your family, your elders, and several generations were stripped of. And so growing up, I had never even heard of the problematic residential schools that are now being unearthed and being exposed. But can you tell our listeners who haven't had the fortune to stand in a room and learn from you, or do not have this part of their history in a textbook, how horrific that experience of taking a child from their home and putting them into residential school was?
So in 2007, the government decided to bring about 94 calls to action. And it was a direct result of the Indian Residential School Agreement settlement that had happened in Canada with the Indigenous people who attended residential schools. The intention was to create a lasting resolution that would definitely break the legacy that the Indian residential schools left. So growing up, I didn't hear a lot of the stories of my grandparents attending residential schools. I didn't understand what trauma was or what intergenerational trauma was and what it looked like as well. I get pretty emotional with this, just reason being, I have a lot of family members that were taken out of the homes, their own homes, taken from their parents' arms, and it was forcibly taken. It was a genocide where the government was attempting to remove the Indian, and it's quoted, remove the Indian from the child. And so Duncan Campbell Scott thought that was the ideal thing to do, to remove the savage from the child. And the only way to do that was to break down the children's upbringing of their traditional ways, their language, those sorts of things. Over the course of the years, people began to encourage residential school survivors to be able to speak their truths. And through that, we started to learn of the many horrific stories that my own family members, many other family members, community members experienced. So experiences like sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, mental abuse had occurred. And in talking to my grandmother, who is 96 today, she once said to me, I didn't have it bad at residential school. And I asked her, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, I wasn't hit. I wasn't sworn at. And I said to my grandmother, my cuckum, I said, were you lonely? She said, every day. I cried myself to sleep every night. I said, did you see your family? My brothers were in the same building, but I was not allowed to go anywhere near them. So my personal belief is that maybe not every child experienced one of those formal types of abuse, but I think every single child that walked into the doors of residential school experienced spiritual abuse. And as an educator, I cringe, I get angry, thinking my responsibility to children is to help build them up rather than break them down. And I don't feel that was the intent of the Indian residential school system when our ancestors attended the school.
Candace, having been in your homes, I was so blessed to meet your father and uncle and other members of your family and was so warmly welcomed. When you talked about this cliche, this directive of removing the Indian from the child, removing the savage. Oh, that just makes me cringe. What does that mean to you hearing that all these years later, that they mean the powers that be, the government, was trying to forcibly break up families and homes and take a part of you away?
So I like to generally believe that everybody is a genuinely good human being. I am still struggling with what the purpose of residential schools really was for John A. Macdonald, who was our first prime minister. And I still struggle today trying to recognize how could this intention to assimilate, to colonize, and to bring a genocide to helpless children, how could that be something that was supposed to civilize our people? I struggle because working in the school system now, I've been able to understand and recognize after being, you know, educated and going to learn through many elders, I've seen and understand a little bit more of what the trauma was really experienced in these schools, in these schoolhouses. And to me, trauma is a form of a disconnect from oneself, really. And that's exactly the intent of what the residential school did. Having said that, we continue to suffer today because we still have that disconnect from oneself. So those of us who hadn't necessarily attended residential schools are continuing to suffer the intergenerational trauma because our grandparents and our parents who raised us showed us and taught us the best they knew how with what they were taught. And because of that and the way they were taught in residential schools to deal with situations, to deal with maybe what we would say is mistakes, our children were so abused that a lot of that carried on into the communities. And our ways of disciplining our children through kindness and helping and determination and all our natural laws were taken away from us and removed from us. So we have to go back and relearn and reawaken our spirits to ensure that we are doing that for not only ourselves, but for those who suffered in silence and those yet to come.
So profound. For those who suffered in silence, and you used the word earlier that is cringeworthy, that is civilized. These young people were put essentially in a residential school where they lived and went to school and weren't always volunteering to go. I know that a lot of were captured and went against their will. But can you explain to the folks around the globe what was taken away from them? If they were taken from their family, what else was taken away from them?
So in a nutshell, what would often happen was an Indian agent would show up at the homes of our families, our relatives, our community members, and the families would have absolutely no choice but to give up their children to the Indian agent. And if they didn't, they would be jailed and lose their children anyways because they were jailed. They basically would take the children, bring them back into the residential schools. And when the children got to the residential schools, the stories I've heard from a number of survivors was first thing would be to cut our hair. And for us to cut our hair is our power, our strength. We use our hair in many ceremonies. Like, for example, when we go through rites of passage, our young ladies cover their hair. So that was such an invasion right from the beginning. And then from there, they moved into showering our children. And for many of our children, we didn't have showers in the homes and we didn't show our body parts to other people. And we would, the children were showered in groups and they were some of the stories I heard, they were thrown wet rags like at their naked bodies and they were so embarrassed. They were so humiliated. So, and then they would get into the next step where they would give them a number. And so they no longer had names, they became numbers. And as they became numbers, that's how they were addressed. They were malnourished in the schools. The food was not healthy at all. But then the children watched on as the caretakers and the staff of the residential schools ate very healthy meals, of which were provided from the gardens that the children worked in and harvested as well. In the classrooms, there was very limited actual curricula that was shared amongst the children. It was basically learning to read or write. But in the classrooms or anywhere in the building, anytime the language, our language, our traditional languages, be it Cree, Blackfoot, we were not allowed to speak our language and we were disciplined harshly for speaking our language. And for many Indigenous people, we believe that in every syllable we speak, There is a spirit in that syllable. So by removing that language, our mother tongue, they were breaking the spirit every opportunity they had received. And for many children who attended the school, they spoke not one word of English. So they were learning foreign ways, and they were told that the language they spoke was from the devil. It was evil. Many children, if they were left-handed, they were beaten because they were using the devil's hand. They were a devil's child. I have family members who reluctantly will speak of the sexual abuse that they encountered. In fact, community members who are very hesitant to share because of the shame of even the physical abuse they endured and how embarrassing it was and how hard and difficult it was to break away from some of that. It was a horrible experience for many.
What I took away when I spent time with your family in your province and in your Treaty 6 was that so many of your family members, like your great-grandmother, were movers and shakers, chiefs and elders who took that pain and made it their purpose to expose, to have reparations, to have a reconciliation. And what has happened in 2021 is a very robust discussion about the deaths that occurred at these residential schools. And so what was that like for you to learn of those mass graves that are now being exposed almost weekly throughout the different provinces of Canada? How devastating is that for you and your family to learn the truth?
I think for many of us, we always knew the truth and we've never doubted it. But the discoveries actually made it a reality to the rest of Canada as to what was happening. And in order to move forward together collectively, I feel that Canada has to learn to acknowledge and accept the malicious history that was imposed on Indigenous peoples. And when we do that, and we do that successfully, we will move forward together. And we're certainly a lot further than we were before. But when things like this happen, the discoveries, you take a few steps back. And it just provides us with evidence that we still have a lot of work to do. And we still have a lot of relationships to build. As an Indigenous person, I know the importance of building those relationships with our allies and how impactful those conversations with our allies are. I don't have access to not every non-Indigenous dinner table where tough discussions like this happen, but I have friends and allies who have access to those conversations. So we need more and more people to get on board and to help fight the battle so those voices that have been silenced can speak through us.
I'm excited that there is movement forward while exposing the malicious past, as you mentioned. But there must have been some real allies and advocates who fought for National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, which just happened on September 30th. So can you talk about what that was like to have the first Truth and Reconciliation Day in your country?
I'm not really sure if a lot of people realize just how powerful these days, these movements are and how much they say to us as Indigenous people. I really believe that those kinds of days give us opportunity to empower one another, educate one another. And when we do that and we take every opportunity to learn from one another, we definitely become a lot more stronger as a nation and more voices are heard. I kind of have mixed feelings about that day, Erin.
That's okay. Well, let's talk about that. I wanted to ask you specifically that question. Because in our country, we share this continent of North America. And in America, while there are similarities, there's also differences. And so in America, for a long time, October 11th was a national holiday called Columbus Day. And Columbus was the first European to come to American shores. And a lot of indigenous people here in America thought that that was the beginning of the genocide, the beginning of horrific incidences to them. So in my state of California, we now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day on October 11th instead of Columbus Day, because I know that took a lot of people that were allies and advocates to not celebrate someone who was the impetus for a future genocide. I know that our country is still grappling with how do we spread this? How does every single state in our union celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day? Because it's not a nationally recognized holiday. So it's still evolving. It's still difficult. And so if you are conflicted, I think that's important for people to understand that a simple holiday doesn't right all wrongs. It doesn't make things go away. So talk about the conflictions and let our audience understand that this was not just an easy solution.
So I just really don't want government officials to feel like, let's just put a Band-Aid on here and everyone will hush for a while. And so with that particular day, sometimes I don't know if everybody involved in making those decisions necessarily knows just how deep rooted that can be for other people and just how meaningful it is. Sometimes we can go through the process of things without the emotion. And it's like Dr. Lira Littlebear talks about the importance of connecting logic to the heart. And so sometimes I feel when we do and make some of these decisions, we don't necessarily connect that logic and that heart. And so I think sometimes I feel like that's the missing piece, that missing component. And so one of the elders always said, the longest trip you're ever going to take in your life is from your head to your heart. And so when I hear elders talk about that, this is in one of those instances where that statement perpetuates what that day is all about. So we can go through the process and the actions of doing, making that a day, but then how in fact are we going to ensure that that day is still encouraging that education to continue for those around the country? So my fear is because it becomes a holiday, historically in the last few years, there was a precedent set where organizations and schools, various businesses were being educated on that particular day. So as exciting as it is to have this day recognized, there are some areas in which I have some concerns just because I don't want it to be become just that, a holiday where people can relax and have a nice, everyone needs to have that TLC time, I know, but this is a day where I hope and I pray that the education for this day and the purpose of this day really continues. So that's my hope for that day.
And I'm so proud of you for sharing that. My hope is exactly what you said, is that rather than sleeping in or celebrating that you're not working, that it's a day for the head and the heart to be one, to learn and do research and to carry that through the other days of the year. So I really appreciate you sharing that. Speaking of reparations, do you feel that the government has tried to acknowledge and therefore make reparations? And what would reparations look like to you if they were to do so?
I feel like we are still in the process of a very strong colonial imposed system, be it in the education system, judicial system, children's services, all the systems that, you know, the government developed. So I struggle because all these systems were created by non-Indigenous people and then imposed on our marginalized population, and they don't work. When it comes election time, everybody's running to the Indigenous people for their support, and then they have these great platforms that we are going to work on ensuring that you have good clean water in the nations. We are going to ensure that we are going to make strong movements with the strong missing and murdered Indigenous woman. We are going to ensure that education is equal. We are going to ensure that there are no more crowded homes in the nation, that there's no poverty, there's no socioeconomic status will equal that of all the municipalities. So we hear these great platforms, and at the end of the day, we hear about truth and reconciliation, and we say, yes, truth comes first, and let's move on to reconciliation. But at the end of the day, I don't see reconciliation. So, and I think that's what for many of us Indigenous people, I can't speak for everyone, but I know it's very frustrating for myself to hear that we've had First Nations on boil water advisories for 30, 40 years. And that was one of the big platforms of Trudeau. And we are still on boiled water advisories. So I'm not sure if sometimes the intent is there and then we just don't get to it or what, but that's enough is enough. We need to get to it. We need to provide the services that every child, every person, every human has access to in this entire country. There's no reason why for many of our children, they're attending schools in conditions where mice are running along the cupboards, where, you know, snow is coming in from the windows because the funding differences from the different school systems is so unfair. It's inequitable, and that can't happen. And those are the things that are frustrating. So if I drive 8 minutes one way and 10 minutes, 12 minutes the other way, and between, you know, for two schools, my child will be sitting in a classroom that is so beautifully put together with glass windows and projectors that are huge, and sitting there with a Chromebook for herself. I drive the other way, and you can't see that happening because of the differences in educational funding. So that's like the frustrating part. So many of our families, in order to receive the services that our children should, because our children are, you know, deserve nothing but the best. Any child and any educator I know will always argue for quality education for every single child, be it a child from wherever. So it's just really frustrating to see the differences continue. And so if you're asking me about, do I feel like we've been, no. Do I feel like we've been promised? Absolutely. And I feel like I said, it's time for reconciliation.
I love that. Reconciliation. You know, in America, we have so many similarities. And as you're speaking about education, it reminds me of a Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, that addressed years ago in the 1950s, exactly what you're talking about. Separate is never equal. And, you know, mere miles may mean the difference of good quality schools versus struggling schools. So when I'm listening to you, what you hearken for me and probably our American audience is our civil rights advocates, folks like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who spoke so passionately the way you speak about folks who are marginalized, people who don't have access to quality education. So I love that you are a fierce fighter for equity. And what would equity look like in your classroom?
When I went to school to be an educator, I was really schooled with a very, very westernized lens. And so I came home to the nation and I began my career on the nation. And that was the strongest opportunity of learning that I ever had in regards to my career. I removed myself from being the expert, and the children became my teachers. And as they became my teachers, I started to open up my mind to the realization of the many challenges that our families face, the many barriers that they face on a daily basis. So my philosophy as an educator was to give as many possible experiences to our children so that they can yearn for those experiences and one day experience them again. Or if they didn't, they can tell the story that they had had the experience. The reality in our communities is that we face so many different barriers, be it financial barriers, be it crowded homes, be it living in homes that have no running water. There's no technology, no Wi-Fi, those kinds of experiences. I just truly believe, and I know I said this before, that it is so important to ensure that every single child that walks into a classroom knows their strength, their gift. And sometimes when we become schooled in a westernized lens, we're trained to always look for the deficiencies first. And as an Indigenous person, it's our belief that we look for the strengths and gifts first. So I really had to understand that being an educator, I have to be aware of my ways of knowing and doing, and I have to be able to separate and then also help and encourage other Indigenous and non-Indigenous educators to learn that perspective, that lens, that worldview. So if could you imagine if everything we did, we looked for strength and gift first before looking for deficiency in anything, not even in just a classroom, but in anything we do. But we're so trained to look for the weakness and sometimes those weaknesses are even the gifts that the children bring. I have a nephew who's autistic and we have learned so much from him. He's so literal about everything. And he reminds us about watching our words and how we say things. Because if we say something, he will show us exactly what he's understanding. And so he's taught us so much. But if we as a family recognized and saw that only as a deficiency, we would have missed out on all the teaching opportunities he's brought for us. So in our ways of knowing, we believe that every child, every person brings gift and strength. And it's our responsibility as the adults, as the cookums or the educators, to embrace those gifts so those children can become collective members of society later on in years. And there's no competition, there's no threat to one another, because we all are able to access and utilize one another to the best potential.
It's beautiful. It's utopia. And I think when I was with your family, what I loved is how you lead with love. And I loved the interconnectivity to nature and your environment. And I love that you talk about strengths and gifts. So can you share with the audience, what are some of those strengths and gifts and interconnectivity to nature that you hold so dear in the Cree Nation?
For us as Indigenous people, we begin in prayer and we begin in ceremony. And so at the end of our prayer, we always recognize all our relations. And so when we say all our relations, we don't only mean those in physical realm, but we mean those also in spiritual realm, those on Mother Earth, being the air, all those elements, the water, the fire, all of those have spirit. So when we talk about work being on the land, we know that there's spirit there, there's life there, and Mother Earth has so much gifts for us, and we honor those gifts because she allows us that opportunity to use those gifts to replenish ourselves. But it is our responsibility to ensure that we are taking care of her, because in order for Mother Earth to take care of us, we need to take care of her. And so as Nehiyawak, free people, for directional people. We believe that that is our job, to ensure that we are making sure the land is clean, the water is clean, and for all of those children yet to come and to live amongst the land. So a lot of the schools are going, you know, are going into, I guess they call it a new teaching trend, but it's not anything new for us as Indigenous people. That's where a lot of, you know, the teachings happened as we were growing, as our grandparents were growing. They lived off the land and they taught and learned from one another that way. So for us, it's not a separate classroom. It's a part of who we are. It's a part of our being.
Throughout this interview, you've used the word spirit. And sadly, when you talked about the westernization in the residential schools, taking away the language, and every syllable that was stripped was taking away a spirit. But what I have learned from you about spirit is the celebration of two spirit. And when you were with the Freedom Writers and the Freedom Writer teachers, you brought tears to our eyes, because in the room there was a few people who are part of the LGBTQIA community. And when you described what two spirits mean in your culture, it was this beautiful celebration, this hearkening and this awakening. So for our audience, can you share what two spirits mean?
So I'm not like the true expert in this area, but the teaching that I've always been taught was, in with two-spirited people, we honor them because it's their gift. They can see the world from two lenses, from the male and female. And so they have a strength that I may not have. And so that's the teaching that I was taught from the elders, and that's one I carry through with my children and my nieces and nephews, and ensure that we respect one another. Because if we shut those doors to those teachings, we limit ourselves with what we can learn from others as well. And so I always fear that limiting, you know, having these really embedded thoughts, like ingrained thoughts, they can really limit our opportunities to great relationships, great friendships, and so much more knowledge. So I just always keep an open mind and an open heart, and I'm always willing to listen to the elders because they have so many great teachings, and that being one of them.
When the Freedom Writers had this idea that we would create a book called Dear Freedom Writer, our goal was to gather Freedom Writer teachers like yourself from all over the globe and find young teenagers who were struggling. And the idea would be they would write a letter and seek a solution. And so I was so thrilled that we were able to find an incredible young woman from your province who lives in Edmonton. And this young woman wrote about that intergenerational trauma, that interconnectivity of spirit. And you were the perfect person to respond to that letter. So my hope is that you could share a little bit of that letter to our audience. The first time you read it to us, we were weeping, we were cheering, and we envisioned you standing in Ottawa, reading it to the Prime Minister Trudeau at some point. That is my hope. Because in that letter, you spoke truth to power. In that letter, you directed all of those years of trauma to have a release. So if you have the letter handy, would you mind, if you have a favorite paragraph or two? It just makes me sit a little taller, feel a little deeper, and weep a little more.
Dear not a victim, but now a survivor. As an Indigenous Cree woman from the Treaty 6 territory, I want to commend you for initiating a dialogue that can be uncomfortable and disheartening for any human being. I also want to begin by acknowledging your pain, anger, and all the emotions that come with this complex form of trauma that unjustly slapped you clear in the face. Your ability to share your story will inspire others with immense hope, understanding, and empathy. It's time for Indigenous people to speak their truths, and your story is an example of just that. I remember an elder stating, "To truly understand comfort, we must know and feel discomfort." Your words of wisdom and the risk you take help to perpetuate this statement. Truthfully and sadly, the pain you experienced on that horrible day has been imprinted on our people for such long periods of time. Unfortunately, these incidents are not isolated, nor are they uncommon to many Indigenous women. We have been targets even before we reach this physical world, and far too often we continue to be subjected to these terrible encounters. It's time for change, and change we will create. You come from a long line of people of dignity, strength, and resilience. By stepping forward, you're showing the country, the world, and our people that we are returning and connecting to our original selves once again. These actions are one step closer to taking our power and pride back. This country carries a malicious and egocentric history that is only starting to be recognized today. The climbing numbers of the unmarked grave sites is forcibly encouraging this country to wake up. The rapes began hundreds of years ago. The ongoing attempts of genocide, colonization, and assimilation have been imposed on our people for centuries. Instead of righting the wrongs, this country made heroes out of those who raped us of our way of life, while silencing the voice of those who were violated. Statues of John A. Macdonald, Canada's first prime minister, are still situated in the most prestigious lands. And for what? To celebrate the architect who designed and constructed Indian residential school systems? These systems were designed to rid the country of the Indian problem. They brought forth practices of abuse upon innocent children that are unthinkable. These schoolhouses become a playground for narcissistic, abusive, and disgusting actions. They continue to leave a haunting legacy of a historical trauma amongst the first people of Turtle Island. We are learning through testimonies of residential school survivors, it was in these cold brick structures that our ancestors started to experience various forms of abuse. And because of this, today, we still feel the pains both directly and indirectly, also known as intergenerationally. The night you were assaulted represents the assaults of many others and many years of similar behaviors that were accepted and hidden. These schools who promised to teach, save, and civilize our babies did the exact opposite. For my entire life, I exhausted myself trying to understand the translation of the word civilized. After receiving 2 undergraduate degrees, 1 graduate degree, and while working amongst Western society, I'm left far more confused than I was as a child. 3 generations before me suffered the direct impacts of dehumanization, but were made to believe they were being molded into civilized, contributing members of society. Civilized? For 10 months of the year, my cookum, grandmother, as a child, cried herself to sleep, longing for the presence of her parents. She did so while the staff of these schools simply watched on and laughed heartlessly. Civilized, my chapon, my great-grandfather, watched his best friend buried alive in a collapsing trench that they had been forced to dig. As my chapon begged for help, the adults looked right through him, as though he himself was already dead to them. Civilized, our young warriors, my uncle being one, had to bear the shame of the sexual perpetrators that robbed him of his innocence and purity. Civilized, my Muslim was beaten because he had taken ill. Even days before his death at the age of 74, he wondered if his hearing loss was from the deadly fever or the savage punches from the vicious staff of the residential school. Similar to you, our elders had their spirits broken, but generations later, we sing our songs, dance our dances, practice our ceremonies, and speak our language. We are still thriving and very much alive. We have access to those knowledge keepers who will assist us in moving forward with clear minds and conscious goals. We got you. You have a nation of survivors behind you. In the most articulate yet nurturing words, our people would say, "Gaipo me agamemo." Don't be discouraged. Continue to persevere. Your story and your grit to fight this war makes you a trailblazer. The more we speak, the more we empower ourselves and one another. Because of your courageousness, I promise there will be at least one young Indigenous woman whose life will be forever changed. She will refuse to live a life of hurt and heartache. No longer will she be submissive and remain silent. And because of you, She will heal. Heroes become heroes by saving one life at a time. You, my girl, are my hero. Sincerely, another Iganuitak Iskwitel, Firekeeper.
Candace, it's so good. I do see you traversing throughout North America, not just reserves and reservations here in America, but to state houses, to tables where there's politicians and pundits. And I think if you read your letter to these folks, they will sit up and they will listen. So what is your hope that will come from your story in Dear Freedom Writer?
That we will one day see a day where my children, my grandchildren, and great-grandchildren won't feel the effects of colonization, oppression, assimilation, but instead walk wholeheartedly amongst an entire nation as a person and not as a color.
Our podcast was designed to bring forth voices of activists and civil rights icons, authors and allies. And you are all of those things. You are such a force to be reckoned with. You have this gentle spirit, but you are truly a force to be reckoned. So my last question for you is, as a force to be reckoned with, if you did have an audience with the Prime Minister and you were able to share your narrative, tell your truth, what would be the message that you would leave behind for your Prime Minister?
If I had the opportunity to have the audience with Prime Minister Trudeau, I would share the experience that I had the opportunity to meet Holocaust survivors when I went down to Long Beach, California. And one of the participants asked one of the Holocaust survivors if she ever felt that she had gotten the revenge on those that had wronged her and her family. And her answer to that question was, each day I look at my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, I feel that that's my revenge. I left with that and I processed that for a very long period of time. And if I was to leave a message to anybody at any level, would be that same message that we are still here. The intent was to rid us. We were never supposed to be here any longer. We were supposed to be long gone. But we are still here, and we have agreements and treaties signed that we didn't sign alone, and both parties need to uphold their end of the bargain. So we are not going anywhere. It's just best you work with us than against us.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Candace Hull, for boldly sharing her experiences as a Native Canadian Cree educator and humanitarian. My dear listeners, may we celebrate the dignity, power, and pride in every culture. May we all be allies and advocates for all Aboriginal communities. And in Candace's honor, may we always have an open heart and an open mind. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. We'd like to thank our publisher, Penguin Random House, for allowing us to share a sneak peek of the story Indigenous Indignation from our upcoming book, Dear Freedom Writer. The story was written and read by Candace Hull. Once again, I'm your host, Aaron Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.